You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a set of 20 lectures, some of them stenographs and others listeners' notes. The next two are just listeners' notes, 20 lectures. Collected Works, Volume 93, translated by John Wood, and it is entitled The Temple Legend. This is Lecture 9, entitled The Essence and Task of Freemasonry from the Point of View of Spiritual Science, Part 3, given in Berlin on the 16th of December, 1904. It is important that we should speak about the higher degrees of Freemasonry, because this manner of instruction sets itself special tasks, certain aspects of which will be discussed in the near future. We are dealing in the main with a special rite that is called the Combined Rite of Memphis and Mizraim. I have already mentioned that the Memphis and Mizraim rite possesses a great number of degrees, that 95 degrees must be undertaken, and that usually the supreme leaders of the Grand Orients, that is, those of Germany, Great Britain, and America, possess the 96th degree. These degrees are so arranged that up to the end of about the 80th to 89th degree, they are divided up in the way I shall presently describe to you. From about the 87th degree onward start the real occult degrees, into which no one can be initiated who has not made a thorough study of the subject. I always make the reservation that in Europe there is nobody who has undertaken all these degrees, or who has really undergone an occult Freemasonry training. But that is of no particular concern as far as Freemasonry goes, because its renewed task still awaits it in the future. And when the time comes, the organization will be available. The vessel will be there, which is needed to carry out what has to be achieved. Now I must mention the various branches of Freemasonry and their tendencies, even if I am only to indicate something briefly. First of all, it is to be borne in mind that the whole of the Masonic higher degrees trace back to a personality often spoken about, but equally very much misunderstood. He was particularly misunderstood by 19th century historians, who have no idea of the difficult situations an occultist can meet in life. This personality is the ill-famed and little understood Cagliostro, the so-called Count Cagliostro, in whom an individuality was concealed, who was recognized in his true nature only by the highest initiates, attempted originally to bring Freemasonry in London, to a higher stage. For during the last third of the 18th century, Freemasonry had fairly well reached the state that I have described. He did not succeed in London at that time. He then tried in Russia, and also at The Hague. Everywhere he was unsuccessful for very definite reasons. Then, however, he was successful in Lyon, forming an occult Masonic lodge of the Philalethes, Searchers After Truth, out of a group of local Masons, which was called the Lodge of Triumphing Wisdom. Readers aside, Philalethes, possibly, I'm going to pronounce it that way, it's spelled P-H-I-L-A-L-E-T-H-E-S, Philalethes. End of readers aside. The purpose of this lodge was specified by Cagliostro. What you can read about it is, however, nothing but the work of ignorant people. What can be said about it is only an indication. Cagliostro was concerned with two things. Firstly, with instructions enabling one to produce the so-called Philosopher's Stone. Secondly, with creating an understanding of the mystic pentagram. I can only give you a hint of the meaning of these two things. They may be treated with a deal of scorn, but they are not to be taken merely symbolically. They are based on real facts. The Philosopher's Stone has a specific purpose, which was stated by Cagliostro. It is meant to prolong human life to a span of 5,527 years. To a free thinker, that appears laughable. In fact, however, it is possible, by means of special training, to prolong life indefinitely by learning to live outside the physical body. Anyone, however, who imagined that no death, in the conventional sense of the word, could strike down an adept, would have quite a false view of the matter. So whoever imagined that an adept could not be hit and killed by a falling roof slate would also be wrong. To be sure, that would usually only occur if the adept allowed it. We are not dealing here with physical death, but with the following. Physical death is only an apparent occurrence for him who has understood the significance of the philosopher's stone for himself and has learned to exteriorize it. For other people, it is a real happening, which signifies a great division in their life. For he who understands how to use the philosopher's stone in the way that Cagliostro intended his pupils to do, death is only an apparent occurrence. It does not even constitute a decisive turning point in life. It is, in fact, something which is only there for the others who can observe the adept and say that he is dying. He himself, however, does not really die. It is much more the case that the person concerned has learned to live without his physical body, that he has learned, during the course of life, to let all those things take place in him gradually, that happen suddenly in the physical body at the moment of death. Everything has already taken place in the body of the person concerned, which otherwise takes place at death. Death is then no longer possible, for the said person has long ago learned to live without the physical body. He lays aside the physical body in the same way that one takes off a raincoat, and he puts a new body on just as one puts on a new raincoat. Now, that will give you an inkling. That is one lesson which Cagliostro taught, the philosopher's stone which allows physical death to become a matter of small importance. The second lesson was the knowledge of the pentagram. That is the ability to distinguish the five bodies of man one from another. When someone says physical body, etheric body, astral body, kama manas body, causal body, bracket, higher manas or spirit self, close bracket, these are mere words, or at best, abstract ideas. Nothing, however, is achieved by that. A person living today, as a rule, hardly knows the physical body. Only one who knows the pentagram learns to know the five bodies. One does not know a body by living in it, but by having it as an object. That is what distinguishes an average person from one who has gone through such a schooling that the five bodies have become objects. The ordinary person does indeed live in these five bodies. However, he lives in them. He cannot step outside of himself and look at them. At best, he can view his physical body when he looks down at his torso or sees it in a mirror. Those pupils of Cagliostro who had followed his methods would thereby have achieved what some Rosicrucians achieved who had basically undergone a training with the same orientation. They were in a school of the great European adepts who taught that the five bodies were realities and not mere concepts. That is called knowing the pentagram and, in quotes, moral rebirth. I will not say that the pupils of Cagliostro never achieved anything. In general, they went as far as comprehending the astral body. Cagliostro was extremely skillful in imparting a view of the astral body. Long before the catastrophe broke over him, he had succeeded in starting schools in Paris, Belgium, St. Petersburg, and a few other places in Europe, in addition to the one in Lyon, out of which later emerged at least a few people who had the basis for some to proceed to the 18th, 19th, and 20th higher degrees of Freemasonry. Thus Count Cagliostro at least had an important influence on occult masonry in Europe before ending his days in the prison in Rome. The world should not actually pronounce judgment on Cagliostro. As I have already indicated, when people speak about Cagliostro, it is as the Hottentots were to speak about the erection of an overhead railway, because the relationship of apparently immoral outward acts to world happenings is not understood. I remarked earlier that the French Revolution arose out of the secret societies of the occultists, and if these currents were investigated further, they would lead back to the school of the adepts. It may be that what Mabel Collins depicted in her novel Flitta is hard to understand. In it she describes, rather grotesquely, how an adept has the world chessboard in front of him in a secret place, and lets the pieces play, and how he, so to speak, controls the karma of a continent upon one very simple little board. It does not quite take place as it is described there, but something on a much greater scale than that does actually happen, of which what is described as Flitta gives only a distorted picture. Now, the French Revolution certainly proceeded from such things as this. There is a well-known story contained in the writings of the Countess Dadamar, it related that before the outbreak of the French Revolution, the Countess Dadamar, one of the ladies-in-waiting to Marie Antoinette, received a visit from the Count of Saint Germain. He wanted to be presented to the Queen and to beg audience of the King. Louis XVI's minister, however, was the enemy of the Count of Saint Germain, who therefore was not allowed into the King's presence. But he described to the Queen with great accuracy and detail the major perils that were looming ahead. Regrettably, however, his warnings were ignored. It was on that occasion that he uttered the great saying which was based on truth, quote, "They who sow the wind shall reap the whirlwind," close quote, and he added that he had uttered this saying millennia previously, and it had been repeated by Christ. Those were words which were unintelligible to the ordinary person. But the Count of Saint Germain was right. I will only add a few more touches which are quite correct. In books about the Count of Saint Germain, you can read that he died in 1784 at the court of the Landgrave of Hessen, who later became one of the most advanced German Freemasons. The Landgrave nursed him until the end. But the Countess Dadamar recounts in her memoirs that he appeared to her long after the year 1784, and that she saw him 6 more times long after that. In reality, he was at that time in 1790 with some Rosicrucians in Vienna, and said, which is perfectly true, that he was obliged to retire to the Orient for the span of 85 years, and that after that time people would again become aware of his activity in Europe. The year 1875 is that of the founding of the Theosophical Society. These things are all connected together in a certain way. In the school founded by the Landgrave of Hessen, also there were two main concerns, the Philosopher's Stone and the knowledge of the pentagram. The Freemasonry founded by the Landgrave of Hessen, at that time, continued to exist in a rather diluted form. In fact, the whole of Freemasonry, as I have described it, is called the Egyptian Rite, the Rite of Memphis and Mizraim. The latter traces its origin back to King Mizraim, who came from Assyria, from the Orient, and after the conquest of Egypt was initiated into the Egyptian mysteries. These are indeed the mysteries which originate from ancient Atlantis. An unbroken tradition exists from that time. Modern Freemasonry is only a continuation of what was established then in Egypt. Before I go into details, I would like to say that Freemasonry, which extends to the higher degrees, is something which, in its more intimate aspect, is quite different from the normal craft masonry. The ordinary craft masonry rests on a kind of democratic principle, and if the democratic principle is to be applied to matters of knowledge, it is obvious that it will lead to a state of affairs in which the brothers who have congregated together will mainly do nothing but bring forward their own views. Truth, however, is something about which one cannot hold one's own views. One either knows a truth or one is ignorant of it. No one can say that the three angles of a triangle add up to 725 degrees instead of to 180 degrees. When people sit together and have a discussion, they talk about their own views, sometimes also about the most elevated things. But all of this exists on the level of illusion, and is just as irrelevant as what a person says who is ignorant of the true sum of the angles of a triangle, and only gives his own opinion about it. Just as one is unable to discuss whether the sum of the angles of a triangle have this or that many degrees, so one is also unable to have a discussion about higher truths. That is why the democratic principle is not applicable to matters of knowledge, for there is no basis of argument on which to discuss them. What distinguishes masonry of the higher degrees from the craft masonry is that one learns to know the truth step by step. Whoever has recognized a thing can no longer hold more than one opinion about it. One has either recognized it or one has not done so. The 96 degrees have, therefore, a certain justification. At the head is the so-called sovereign sanctuary, who is identical with what is known as the Grand Orient in Freemasonry, and is in possession of the real occult knowledge. He knows the path and the speech of that which can be read in the Masonic Manifesto, and which makes it possible to hear the voice of the wise men of the East. When he has reached this step, he is certainly in a position to hear the voice of the wise masters. So far, however, must one have worked one's way up that one is in possession of very definite knowledge, and also of definite inner qualities and inner capacities, which are by no means purely covered by the conventional bourgeois virtues, but are something more meaningful and intimate. I would note that compared with what we have been speaking about here, what theosophical literature reveals of a theoretical or practical nature forms only an elementary part, so that the theoretical side of the higher degrees of Freemasonry far surpasses what can be divulged in popular theosophy. What can be disclosed there is dependent upon the permission given by the adepts who allow these things to be popularized to a certain degree, but it is not possible to make all knowledge public. It is correct to say that humanity will be astonished by some of the discoveries that will be made in the near future. But they will be rather premature discoveries, and will therefore cause some havoc. The task of the Theosophical Society consists mainly in preparing people for such things. For instance, what I described at the beginning as the knowledge of the Philosopher's Stone was formerly much more universally known than it is today, and indeed it was known already during a certain period of the Atlantean epoch. At that time, the possibility of conquering death was really something which was commonly known. I only wish to remark that I was not very happy about allowing this truth to appear in print recently. Therefore, where this should have come in the discussion about Atlantean times in the Lucifer article, a row of dots was printed in place of those things which may not yet be communicated. It cannot even yet be communicated in its entirety. There is a very similar piece of information recorded by a very advanced medium, which appeared in the title Theosophical Review, dealing with exactly the same thing in a rather different form. The overcoming of death in Atlantean times is naturally preserved in the memories of the individuals concerned without their being aware of it. There are many people reincarnated today who passed through that period in their former lives and who are led to such revelations through their own memories. That will first of all lead to a kind of overrating of certain medical discoveries. People will imagine that medical science was the discoverer of such things. In reality, people will have been led to them through their own memories of Atlantean times. Certain things will mature in the near future, and therefore we shall speak about them. This makes it necessary to see the need of a step-by-step advance in the gaining of knowledge. This step-by-step advance is therefore rightly emphasized by those who wish to revive the Mizraim and Memphis rite at the present time. Even if this does not succeed during the next year or two, one must not think that failure in such things is of any significance. There is a man at the head of the American Mizraim movement whose significant character constitutes a sure guarantee of constancy in the advance. This is the excellent Freemason, John Yarker. It is difficult to say at the moment what form the matter will take in Great Britain and Germany. You will perceive that one must reckon with the human material concerned, and that the German movement, therefore, if it is to concern itself with such matters, will also have to reckon with what is available in this direction. If genuine occultists are to take part in such things, they must needs be active in one or other direction. They will not always be able to take part in such things. Even the masters, when they prescribe something of this kind, have to take their cue from great universal laws. If, therefore, you hear something concerning the German Mizraim Memphis tendency, you should not imagine that this now has significance for the future. It is only the frame into which a good picture may later be put. This German Mizraim order stands under the overall guidance of a certain Reuss, who holds the actual leadership in Great Britain and Germany today. Then the well-known Karl Kellner also works in this direction. The actual literary work is in the hands of Dr. Franz Hartmann, who serves the Mizraim rite with his pen to the very utmost. That is as much as I can impart to you in this or that fragment from here or there concerning this movement. Now I can only characterize what is involved here in general terms. There are four kinds of instruction given in the Mizraim rite. The 96 degrees can therefore be achieved through four different kinds of instruction or disciplines. These four disciplines, by means of which one advances, are the following. First, the so-called symbolic instruction, or discipline. By means of this, certain symbols can be recognized as facts. The person concerned is instructed in the occult laws of nature, through which quite definite effects are produced, through cyclic movements in humanity. The second kind of instruction or discipline is the so-called philosophic one. It is the Egyptian hermetic discipline. It consists of a more theoretical kind of instruction. The third kind of instruction is the so-called mystical discipline, which is based more upon inner development, and which, if rightly applied, would lead, above all else, to the appropriate manipulation of the philosopher's stone, that is, to the overcoming of death. That is essentially expressed in one of the sentences which I read out to you, which stated that by means of Freemasonry, everyone is able to convince himself of the fact of immortality. It depends, however, as the Kabbalah says, whether this is requested or not. The fourth kind of instruction is the Kabbalistic one. It consists in the recognition of the principles of world harmony in their truth and reality. The ten basic, readers aside, there's a gap in the text, end of readers aside. By means of each of the four paths, one can rise to a higher perception through the Mizraim rite. But there is actually no one within the ranks of Freemasonry today who would accept the responsibility of giving practical guidance to anyone, because those concerned have not undergone these things themselves. And the whole affair is a provisional arrangement, and only intended to provide a framework for something which is still to come. It is possible that this framework will be filled with occult knowledge. Occult knowledge has to be cast in existing molds. The important thing is that such molds exist in the world. If there is molten metal and no mold into which to pour it, you are unable to do anything but let it run out in one lump. So it is also with spiritual currents. It is important that molds exist into which can be poured the spiritual metal that is symbolized by the molten sea. That will become recognized when what is now seemingly only vegetating receives form for outward manifestation. Last time I read to you from a speech by the English Prime Minister Balfour. From that, then, it is already noticeable that certain things are physical truths today that are in primeval occult perceptions. If you read Blavatsky's title, The Secret Doctrine, you will find there a passage relating to electricity, which expresses, word for word, what physicists are now gradually arriving at. What is written there is, however, only a hint at what is actually involved. It is the physical atom that is in question. This was misunderstood by all outward, but not occult science, until 4 or 5 years ago. It was taken to be a body having mass in space. Nowadays, one is beginning to recognize that this physical atom bears the same relationship to the force of electricity that a lump of ice bears to the water from which it has been frozen. If you conceive of water becoming frozen to ice, so is the ice also water, and in like manner, the atom of physics is nothing else but frozen electricity. If you can grasp this point completely, and were to go through the statements about the atom contained in all the scientific journals until a year or two ago, and were to regard them as rubbish, you will have more or less the right idea. It is only very recently that science has been able to form a conception of what the atom is. It stands in the same relationship to electricity as ice does to the water out of which it has been frozen. The physical atom is condensed electricity. I regard Balfour's speech as something of extreme importance. It is, readers aside, there's a gap in the text, end of readers aside, something which has been published since 1875, in brackets 1879, possibly, question mark. The fact has been known to occultists for millennia. Now, one is beginning to realize that the physical atom is condensed electricity. But there is still a second thing to be considered, what electricity itself is. That is still unknown. They are ignorant of one thing, namely where the real nature of electricity must be sought. This nature of electricity cannot be discovered by means of any outer experiments or through outer observation. The secret which will be discovered is that electricity, when one learns to view it from a particular level, is exactly the same as what human thought is. Human thought is the same thing as electricity, viewed one time from the inside, another time from the outside. Whoever is now aware of what electricity is knows that there is something living within him which in a frozen state forms the atom. Here is the bridge from human thought to the atom. One will learn to know the building stones of the physical world. They are tiny condensed monads, condensed electricity. In that moment when human beings realize this elementary occult truth about thought, electricity, and the atom, in that same moment they will have understood something that is of the utmost importance for the future and for the whole of the sixth post-Atlantean epoch. They will have learned how to build with atoms through the power of thinking. This will be the spiritual current which will again have to be cast in the molds that have been prepared for it by occultists over millennia. But because the human race had to pass through the era of the development of understanding and to look away from the true inner work, the molds have become mere shells. But they still retain their function as molds, and the right kind of knowledge will have to be poured into them. The occult investigator obtains his truth from the one side, the physical scientist from the other. Just as Freemasonry has developed out of working masonry, out of the building of cathedrals and temples, So one will in future learn to build with the smallest of building blocks, with entities of condensed electricity. That will call for a new kind of masonry. Then industry will not be able to carry on any more as it does today. It will become so chaotic and will only be able to work purely out of the struggle for existence per se, as long as man does not know. Reader's aside, there's a gap in the text. End of reader's aside, footnote. There is a gap here in the shorthand report. However, a completion of the sentence is to be found in legible writing. Bracket. What has to be poured into these husks in the way of thought. End of footnote. Then it would be possible for someone in Berlin to drive into the city in a cab, while in Moscow a disaster which he had caused was taking place, and nobody at all would have any inkling that he had been the cause of it. Wireless telegraphy is the beginning of this. What I have portrayed is in the future. There are only two possibilities available. Either things go on chaotically, as industry and technology have done until now, in which case it will lead to whoever has the possession of these things being able to cause havoc, or else it will be cast in the moral mold of Freemasonry. Footnote. This last sentence appears as follows in the notes of Marie Steiner von Sievers. Quote, these things will either continue chaotically, as industry and technology have done until now, or harmoniously, as is the aim of Freemasonry. Then the highest development will be achieved. End of footnote. There's a question. Why is the Catholic Church so antagonistic toward Freemasonry? Answer from Steiner. The Catholic Church does not want what is coming in the future. Pius IX was initiated into Freemasonry. He tried, through the chapter of Clermont, to bring about a connection between the Jesuits and the Freemasons. That did not succeed. And therefore the old enmity between these two remained. Our Jesuits know little about these things, and the clergy are also unaware of what is involved. The actual clergy, readers aside, there's actually a large gap in the text here, and readers aside, the Trappists have to keep silent, for it is known that by doing so, an important faculty of inspired speech in the next life is implanted. That is indeed only to be understood through a knowledge of reincarnation. The end of Lecture 9.